This is Law and Disorder. That door slamming did not slam on Lynn Stewart.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the dimensions of the Lynn Stewart victory.
Today we're also going to discuss the nasty piece of police state litigation. They call it the Military Commission Act. We call it the Police State Act. They call it protecting ourselves from terrorism. We call it keeping people in cages forever.
Or you could call it, let's close down the Center for Constitutional Rights Act. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. On Monday morning, October 16th, Lynn Stewart walked into the courtroom with her husband on one side of her and her toothbrush in her pocket. She didn't know whether she was going to be starting the beginning of a 30-year sentence. At 2:30 that afternoon, she walked out free on bail, pending appeal, and given a relatively light sentence. We bring to you today the voices in and around the courthouse on that historic, maybe limited, but historic victory for Lynn Stewart.
She's an amazing woman and an amazing attorney. I've listened to her speak. She didn't do anything wrong. She was a court-appointed attorney. It's her job to defend her client. They listen to her conversations with her client. That's against the law. And now they're prosecuting her for some little administrative nonsense, which apparently, if she had been in jail, she would have had 30 days punishment, not being threatened with 30 years. I think the real criminals are in the Pentagon and in the corporations that literally steal our tax money and use it to create weapons of such obscene proportions that I don't think there are any words invented in any language to describe this kind of insanity.
I have for several years now been working on this, building support for Lynn Stewart. I see this as a real threat to the rule of law in this country. I've personally had the experience of needing a strong advocate on my behalf when I've been in the court. Not at the level Lynn works at, but certainly I understand how important advocacy is. The whole point of this prosecution is to intimidate defense attorneys, is to intimidate people who will take on unpopular cases, to actually really undermine the principle of our legal system that everybody who's accused has the right to a vigorous defense. And so this is very important. And Lynn was picked as a symbol because she's always been out there for the most despised defendants, for people no one else will defend. And that's why we need her, but that's also why they picked her, because they could go after her and intimidate other lawyers. And I know it's, and I know other lawyers have been intimidated. That's why I'm out here. Is I'm the parent of a 21-year-old. I am scared of the world that she's about to start off into. It's not nearly as friendly a world as I faced when I was 21 at the height of the Vietnam War. It's harder for people to get started in careers. Their free speech is much more circumscribed. The boundaries are getting tighter, as well as the economic opportunities. The economic opportunities for young people are much less than they were when I was coming up 35 years ago than they are. And the opportunities for self-expression are much less because of the narrowing of our civil rights and liberties. And this is going on for decades. And you can tie together everything from Reagan going after the unions, the free trade stuff that Clinton and Carter were involved in as much as any Republican, undermining the unions. And the unions are a big force for free speech in this country, and have been because they have economic power. But that's why they went after them. And now they're going after the defense bar so that people don't get defense. What kept us free through the McCarthy era was the fact that they were vigorous attorneys. They could defend people. They defend people who were despised. You know, the Rosenbergs could get good attorneys. They were able to get attorneys, and not just the ACLU, but private attorneys were willing to take on those cases. They're going to be intimidated from this sort of work now. Between this...
Hold on one.
Yeah.
The judge recognizing Lynn's 30 years of contribution and pro bono work and charity work to the poor, to the communities of color, sentenced her to a term of imprisonment of 28 months in a situation where the government and the Department of Probation recommended a sentence of 30 years. So while it is certainly a hardship that she's going to have to serve if she doesn't prevail on appeal, is going to have to serve some time in jail. Given what the government said about her, what the government was requesting, I think that this has to be looked at as a big victory for Lynn and her supporters and all the work that they did.
So 28 months, Michael.
She shouldn't have done a day. It was a frame-up from the beginning. The government admitted that it was to make an example to intimidate other lawyers. It's a victory for a long time. It's also a victory since they're giving her bail pending appeal. What they put her through, they took away her license to practice. They did intimidate lawyers. It was a good step forward for us, but there's a long way to go to reverse the damage to constitutional rights that this government is doing.
Well, look, this was a political prosecution from beginning to end. It was conduct that took place under Clinton that Clinton even refused to do anything about. When Ashcroft and Bush took office, they decided to make an example in a political persecution is a better word, out of Lynn Stewart, and to send a message really to other attorneys. And I remember when we were dealing with our Guantanamo attorneys, they were very nervous when they heard that Lynn got convicted about continuing to represent Guantanamo detainees. So while I hate any day in jail or conviction for Lynn at all, I think the government still at the same time received a major setback by not getting the 30 years they asked for. And we're glad to have Lynn be able to walk out of the court in a few minutes as a woman who has bail pending appeal.
That's right. And it ain't over. Just remember, she's out on bail, continue, and we got time to fight so she never goes to jail. There you go. Never.
I am very grateful to the judge that he gave me time off for good behavior. And he gave it to me in advance of the sentence when he said that my extraordinary work meant that I could not get a sentence that the government wanted. They were disappointed, but I tell you, he did a fair and right thing, and I am grateful to him, but I am more grateful to the people who showed up today, the people who have showed up, the people who had the meetings, the people who had dinners in their apartments, the people who raised funds, whatever it was, the support and love of the people is what has sustained me. I'm standing here with my three of my 14 grandchildren. My lawyers pointed out to the judge that under new regulations, the government could have forbade me to ever see them again. This is how we have become in this country. But now, and I hope the government realizes their error, because I am back out, and I am staying out until after an appeal that I hope will vindicate me, that I hope will make me back into the lawyer I was.
We love you, Lynn. We love you.
And most especially for these guys. You know, you get very sentimental about your grandchildren. So.
Name on your ass, bro.
Thank you.
Any regrets?
Any regrets? I don't think anybody would say that going to jail for 2 years is something you look forward to. But as my clients have said to me, I can do that standing on my head. The circle continues. We are going to go on. We have more struggle. There is a time that cries out for renewed resistance to a government that is not only overreaching in a case like mine, I'm the point person, but to a government that overreaches into all our lives. I see the people before me today. We are not torturers. They are torturers, and we have to stop the torture. I do hope that we will be vindicated on appeal. We are certainly going to take a militant and timely appeal, and that there are plenty of issues, and we hope that that will be the result. But I tell you, it is such a feeling of relief. I had my medications, my book. I had a pair of sweatpants to change into. Because I was prepared for the worst. But like all Irish people, you prepare for the worst, something good happens. And something good did happen. Something good. I'm extraordinarily grateful to my lawyers. I have to, me the lawyer has to mention the lawyers. There are five lawyers that have represented me. We are a contentious group. We have had fights. We have had screaming, yelling fights about what to do, when to do it, how to do it. But you know, I've said to them, and I've said to all of you, I believe in struggle. Struggle is how things get good. When we struggle, we come out with the best solution. And they know that we were struggling, and they showed it today. Their remarks, their work was all there. The 500 letters, or the, what am I saying, 1,100 letters, certainly are one of the things that moved this judge. I have to also thank my defense committee, East Coast, West Coast, and all around the town. Because I tell you, the work on the website, the work to keep the news out there, the work to keep everybody informed, and to get people out to court, they did yeoman service, and particularly Pat Levasseur and Jeff Mackler in particular. So I tell you, last night we were at Riverside Church. We had over 700 people that turned out. But the tribute and the uplift from that marvelous meeting, now I have to figure out where can we get a space big enough for a party for 800 people. But we'll find it. I have faith. First I rest, but then we will celebrate this. We will claim a victory here. This is not to say we're putting anybody's face in it or we're not humble to be happy to go home today and happy to be able to fight the appeal. But the fact is, this is a great victory against an overreaching government. And I thank all of you for that victory. You all had a part of it. You all are part of me. Thank you. Amen.
Lynn Stewart's just walked out of the courthouse. She's free pending bail. Jeff Mackler was in the courthouse all day, heard everything, took notes. Jeff Mackler is the head of the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee out in California. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Jeff.
Glad to be with you, Mike.
Jeff, it must have been so dramatic in there. You were in there all day. There wasn't even a lunch break. Tell us what it was like.
Well, it certainly was an amazing day. It started with the judge hearing the case of Ahmad Sattar, who the government and the probation department recommended a life sentence. And the judge reduced that to 24 years in prison. Subtract from that the 4.5 years he's already served, and you subtract from that 15% federal reduction, he should be out in 17 years. In my opinion, Sattar, innocent man, he's a victim of the climate of the times. He was part of the defense team, and whatever mistakes he might have made, in my opinion, were extremely minor. Then came Lynn's case, and Lynn's attorneys, five of them, put on a presentation designed to mitigate the sentence which the judge was mandated to mete out. And they brought up every aspect of Lynn's life. Over 1,100 letters had been submitted to the court, I think, or had been received, and over 500 submitted to the judge, and he's testified that he had read every one of them. And they received letters from former judges and former prosecutors and academics across the country, all of whom were in detail familiar with the case. The judge had to decide whether or not to go along with the prosecution's proposal and the probation department's proposal that Lynn serve essentially a death sentence, 30 years. And in the end, he sentenced Lynn to 28 months, or 2 years and 4 months, which will be mitigated by 15% less, so she should be out in 2 years. There was a debate with the prosecution, the government, who argued that she should be not granted bail pending her appeal, and the judge rejected that argument as well. The judge considered mitigating circumstances and the prosecution's argument. In fact, he agreed to enhance the original sentence that was asked for on the grounds of the existing laws that he was obligated to uphold. And that sent a shockwave through us, because an enhancement of prison of the sentence proposed by the prosecution and the probation department would have meant even a longer sentence. But as he got into it, he made a number of points that were quite telling. He said that Lynn had served 30 years of magnificent service to working people, that after 30 years she didn't have a dime in her pocket, that she depended the poor people of this country and had made a great contribution to society, and that had to be taken into consideration. They also took into consideration, as a minor but important factor, Lynn's health. She has, she's recovering from breast cancer. She requires regular treatment. And they took into consideration the fact that her release of the a press release from the blind sheik Omar Abdel Rahman, however much they considered it illegal, resulted in no harm to anyone. And they took into consideration the hundreds of letters that were received across the country testifying to Lynn's life as a fighter for the oppressed, as a school teacher in Harlem. All of this was recorded in the record, as well as the rest of Lynn's record and each of her life. And each of these circumstances was used to mitigate the jail sentence. So for a convicted terrorist on five counts, including conspiracy to aid and abet murder, conspiracy to aid and abet a terrorist plot, and all the other horrible things, Lynn Stewart walked out today with what amounts to less than a two-year sentence. And Lynn said to us, I can do that standing on my head. And she also said, I have confidence in my appeal that I will be vindicated, and her case will be appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals. As far as Mohammed Yousry is concerned, he was the one that the prosecution and the probation department recommended a sentence of 20 years for, and his sentence ended up to be 20 months, and when you take the time off, he'll serve a year and a half. He's out on bail, pending his appeal. He announced his intention to appeal, and I think that if you take the sum total of the day, given the struggle that Lynn has gone through for 3 years now, she has won support from one end of the country to another. I think we have to chalk it up to an amazing victory to working people who struggled in a united way to defend an innocent woman against an unjust system. Lynn said the real criminals in this country, the real terrorists of the United States government, those are the real torturers, those are the people whose rule we have to challenge. So I'm extremely happy to walk out of the prison with Lynn today. She's currently having dinner with her family. Her entire family was there, and they were absolutely overjoyed. Her attorneys were magnificent. Liz Fink was in charge of the sentencing. Josh Dreitel spoke. He was in charge of the overall defense. Jill Shalit Levine gave a brilliant exposition of the medical consequences of any incarceration for Lynn, and everyone else chipped in. It was a magnificent team effort. Lynn said that the lawyers fought among themselves all the time. She said that's what a healthy dialogue is in this world. They came up with the right solution, and they made it impossible. The defense committee made it impossible. People around this country made it impossible to serve this so-called convicted terrorist much more, any more than the minimal time that she was sentenced to today. I should say that, of course, when the judge finally, after hearing Liz Fink present her objections to the indictment, to the probation report, she spent a good 45 minutes taking apart the government's report piece by piece, and the judge was compelled to literally edit, eliminate, or void certain parts of the government's probation report, from the most minor things like spelling mistakes to major things, that is, unsubstantiated accusations that could be used by the probation department to make Lynn's life in prison horrible. Liz Fink pointed out to the judge that any prison time would be a death sentence to Lynn, given the state of her health. And she mocked the prosecution's frame-up of Lynn, she didn't use that word, by saying that to the judge, are you kidding? Do you believe for 1 minute in the government's proposition that Lynn should spend 30 years of her life in jail? Do you know who you're talking about? I have never seen such a magnificent presentation. And indeed, Judge Cottle was compelled to listen to it all and agreed with a considerable portion of what Liz Fink did as she presented the case. But when it came to his final conclusions after all the evidence regarding sentencing was heard, Judge Cottle began in a frightening way, I tell us. It made us practically fall down to the floor in our seats. He said that there was evidence that Lynn had conspired to, you know, commit terrorist acts, that she had knowledge that, that some of the people she was associating with were terrorists, and she had collaborated with the blind sheik Omar Abdel Rahman to violate the prison regulations on two separate occasions, that it was not an accidental matter, that she repeatedly violated the special administrative orders. Of course, this all came from the evidence presented in the frame-up trial a couple of years ago and Lynn's conviction. So after we heard the judge affirm under the law, under the specifications of the law as to what defines a terrorist activity, Lynn's guilt in participating in these conspiracies to aid and abet terrorism, we suspected the worst. But to our amazement and joy, he took into consideration who the real Lynn Stewart was. It seemed to be a great contradiction to me. On the one hand, the judge certified that the jury had properly found Lynn guilty of the most heinous acts against the United States, the people of the world, conspiring to aid terrorist acts that could take the lives of people in the United States and or other countries. And then this very same judge, after specifying the violations of the law, went on to enumerate the reasons why Lynn Stewart should not serve anything other than a relatively short prison sentence. From 30 years, it went down and down and down as he took into consideration every aspect of Lynn's life. At one point, he virtually said that her 30 years of service to the poor at a very little pay essentially amounted to her sentence or time served. And that in itself was a recognition that this judge understood, however much in a twisted way, in my view, that it was impossible to put a person like Lynn in prison and not pay the price in loss of credibility among the masses in this country and on the criminal justice system itself. So I think it was, again, a frightening day, but an amazing day, a victory for Lynn Stewart and her family, and a victory that we will now take home when we struggle to reverse the 2 years and the conviction itself, restore Lynn to her legal practice from which she is still banned, and move on to the next struggle against a government that knows no end to lies and corruption.
Jeff, Lynn Stewart had one of the best legal teams you could imagine, a real dream team for the movement. You had Liz Fink, Josh Dreitel, Ellen Yaroshevsky, Jill Shallow-Levine, and Susan Jordan. Experienced lawyers, between the five of them, you probably have over 150 years in the court on the side of the people. It was those five splendid lawyers that today got the judge to slap the government in the face. It's a victory, big victory, qualified victory, because she still got over 2 years hanging over her head and attorneys out there intimidated, which was the purpose of the government frame-up of Lynn, but a victory nonetheless. I wanted to know from you, because I know you got a good memory and you sat in that courthouse all day. Can you sum up what some of the attorneys had to say to the judge that was so persuasive?
Well, I was impressed by every presentation. Josh Dreitel said that Lynn's case is compelling and unique and takes place in the atmosphere of 911 in this country. He said that Stewart has received an unprecedented number of letters from former prosecutors and others involved in the case and in knowledge of Lynn. He said, in my 25 years of service, I don't remember an attorney of this caliber ever standing before a judge for sentencing of 30 years in prison. He said, this is a tragedy of awful proportions, and he demanded that the judge consider only a non-custodial sentence. The attorney for Ahmad Sattar made the point that Sattar had made the statements that he had made in the context of his outrage and incredible anger at the Israeli government murdering Palestinian children. And indeed, Sattar himself, once again sentenced to 24 years, made the point that, yes, it is true, he was outraged at the foreign policy of Israel and the foreign policy of the United States government. So the politics of this case wasn't kept out by Lynn's attorneys, by Sattar's, or by anyone else.
Can you tell us more about what Josh Dreitel said?
Yes. He pointed out that if Lynn Stewart goes to jail, it'll have a chilling effect on the practice of law in the United States. To put a lawyer who is a zealous advocate for her client in jail for issuing a press release in good faith, which meant no harm to anyone, would be a crime against the legal profession and essentially stop many, many lawyers across the country, a number of whom had already refused to sign statements and send it to the judge on their law firm stationery for fear of persecution. It would have a chilling effect on the practice of law and place lawyers in an untenable situation. He said, throughout history, crises have brought forth harsh judgments that only hindsight has been able to foresee or correct. And he urged the judge to use his vision today and not sentence Lynn in the context of the political atmosphere that has shredded the Bill of Rights in the United States today. Of course, the judge made no comment on that, but his sentence, I think, was a telling one. His sentence, which Lynn is compelled to accept and happy because she was the alternative was 30 years, was a small sentence relative to the difficulties of the times that we face. And I think it's only when we collectively challenge these times, challenge the reaction that is popping up everywhere in the country, that we'll be able to win Lynn Stewart's complete freedom and restore her to her former position as a lawyer.
Jeff Mackler, head of the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee out in California, just came out of the courthouse, spent the whole day at the sentencing of Lynn Stewart and the other two. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure to be with you, Mike.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Today we want to give you a bit of an update on what's called the Military Commission Act. The Military Commission Act was actually signed by the President on October 17th at a signing ceremony in which the President went on and on in front of with a bunch of guys from Homeland Security saying, see, look what I'm doing to stop terrorism. This act will help us a lot. This will do it. And of course, you have to look at the Military Commission Act as something that the president signed and got through Congress before the upcoming election as a way of saying, no matter what's happening in Iraq, no matter how many Iraqis and Americans are being killed, we're making our country safer, and we're going to do it through this Military Commission Act. Now, I think probably most of you know something about the Military Commission Act, although while it's covered somewhat in the newspapers, it's not covered that much. And so we want to really talk a bit about its major provisions. When we think about the purpose of Law and Disorder, and we have the quote from Bill Kunstler about the police state is emerging piece by piece, and at a certain point it'll be irreversible. This is Michael Smith's contribution. It's a Bill Kunstler quote, but Michael always talks about it. And it's really the Military Commission Act, I think, as Michael has said, is a qualitative change in what we have in the United States right now. It really is the piece by piece, but it really is getting to the point where it may well be irreversible, certainly in the next period of time. And people ask me, they say, well, if the Democrats win, are they going to restore the right to habeas corpus? Are they going to really stop torture? And my answer is that, look, it's better if the Democrats win than if they don't. But I've never actually ever seen them reverse anything that's happened that's really bad. And somehow acts, legislation, nasty, repressive stuff like the Military Commission Act, it really sets the floor, sadly, for the next administration that comes in. And my best experience on Democrats not changing is when we were doing the Haitian refugee litigation, and it was during the Bush 1 period, and Bush 1 had opened a HIV camp in Guantanamo for HIV-positive Haitians who should have been given asylum in the United States, but because of their status as HIV people, were not. And Clinton promised us before he took office that he would close the camp. Right before, after he was elected, he said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not closing the camp, and that's it. And in the end, the Democrats did nothing about closing that HIV camp. We had to go to court. The one thing they did is when we gave them legal cover by winning, they didn't appeal the case. I don't think I'm very optimistic that the Democrats are going to reverse the Military Commission Act. But I do want to discuss the three or four aspects of that act that, as Michael Smith said, is a qualitative difference in terms of what's going on. And as someone else said to me today, this is not just the emerging police state anymore. This is actually the blueprint. This is it, guys. We're talking about a police state, and particularly for non-citizens right now in the United States as well as abroad. It's here. It's really here. This is the police state for them. And by police state, I really mean a state in which the dictator, the king, the president, whatever word you want to use to describe the maximum authority in this case, can do whatever he wants to whatever human being he wants. Anyway, there's four or five key aspects. I'll go over them briefly. The first, which I think many of you have probably heard about, is the suspension, or really I would call the abolition of the writ of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus means you have the body, bring the body in front of the court, and let the person who is detained or jailed test their detention. In other words, if the government, the administration, a cop, a federal policeman, anybody picks you up, detains you, habeas corpus says you have the absolute right to go in front of a court and say to the administration or the government, what is your legal justification for holding me? It's considered the fundamental right in any democracy, in any kind of accountability for an executive. If you don't have the right of habeas corpus, think about it. Tomorrow the president can go pick you up, put you in jail, disappear you, and you're never heard from again and never charged. Someone said to me the other day that it came originally out of the Magna Carta. You're 12, 15 in England. Nobles, with an upsurge really from people underneath them, forced the king to be accountable, to be an authority under law. You couldn't just put people in jail. And as was said to me, well, the one thing the nobles did that was really noble was get the writ of habeas corpus through. And the one thing we can know that Bush, who considers himself noble, is not doing at all and is completely ignoble, or whatever word that is that basically abolishing the writ. So what this statute does, this Military Commission Act, and I want to say what I call this is the Police State Act. I don't really think we should refer to it as the Military Commission Act anymore. It's the Police State Act, the PSA. So what it does is it abolishes the writ of habeas corpus. And it abolishes it not just for 460 people who the Center for Constitutional Rights and others represent at Guantanamo Bay. It abolishes it for any alien or non-citizen, even legal permanent residents in the United States who get arrested or detained by the United States and labeled, or by the administration, by the president, and labeled as enemy combatants. So tomorrow, the president can pick up a legal permanent resident, your neighbor or anybody else, someone here on a tourist visa, pick them up, say, you're an enemy combatant. The self-definition is really up to him. Say, you're an enemy combatant, put him in a slammer, and that's the end of the ballgame. Now, historically, of course, the Constitution prohibits suspension of the writ in cases of rebellion or invasion. But that's not what's happening here. This is not a suspension, for starters, during a particular time of crisis, as Lincoln was the last one that did that during the Civil War with congressional consent. This is actually the abolition for an entire class of people, the class being anyone who's not a U.S. citizen. And let me just say, this is not just about non-U.S. citizens. It's going to come to U.S. citizens because the definition of enemy combatant encompasses U.S. citizens. So while they haven't suspended or abolished the writ for U.S. citizens, what they have done is said they can be enemy combatants. Now, think about it for a second. We represent, in fact, the Center recently, the Center for Constitutional Rights, really was honored along with Maha Arar. Maha Arar was the Canadian citizen deported to Syria and tortured. And you'd think that after all of the information that's come out about Maha Arar, the U.S. sending him to a country where he can be tortured, the Canadians doing a 1,200-page investigation that took 3 years saying the guy's completely innocent, they knew he was going to be tortured, what the heck was the U.S. doing? And the Canadians, at least the part of the parliament, apologizing to Maher Rahr. You would think that the congressmen wouldn't have be like ostriches with their heads in the ground and say, hey, maybe we shouldn't authorize this again. But if you look at the Military Commission Act, what happened to Maher Rahr, what happens to people under this outsourcing torture or rendition program can happen again. In fact, it's essentially giving people the authority to send Maher Rahrs to other countries or to U.S. secret CIA detention facilities, deny them the writ of habeas corpus, torture them, and keep them overseas. So in any case, I want to go back to the summary. First, it denies the writ of habeas corpus to non-citizens. We've got that. The second thing it does is it has a broad definition of who can be an enemy combatant. It denies it the writ to non-citizens, but of course they have to be designated enemy combatants. But enemy combatants are simply who the president decides will be an enemy combatant. I don't want to get into the technicalities. That's really what it amounts to. And enemy combatants can be U.S. citizens or they can be non-citizens. Now, in the case of a non-citizen, as I said, they're finished. That's the end of the road for those guys. In the case of citizens, they supposedly have a writ of habeas corpus that they can still file. Unclear to me how good of protection that is. There is currently a U.S. enemy combatant, or two of them, in U.S. custody. One was, he's just out, is Jose Padilla. He's out of being an enemy combatant. He's still in prison. For 3 years, he tried to say, you can't label me an enemy combatant. He filed a writ of habeas corpus. They jerked him around for 3 years. And when the case was about to reach the Supreme Court to test whether Jose Padilla could be, as a U.S. citizen, picked up in the United States, be classified as an enemy combatant, what did they do? They charged him with some crime down in Florida so they wouldn't get a court test of whether they can make U.S. citizens into enemy combatants. So the writ of habeas corpus for a U.S. citizen labeled an enemy combatant, it's illusory because you're going to litigate the thing for 3 or 4 years, you're still going to be in prison, and then what are they going to do? They'll charge you in some crime that'll be tried another 3 years from now. So we have now habeas corpus and definitions of enemy combatant. The two other parts of this statute are concerned, first, torture. The U.S. has engaged really for 5 years in torture. From Guantanamo to Bagram to Abu Ghraib, they've engaged in torture. McCain claims he wanted to stop torture in this act and he was holding the act up. But in fact, that was all fake because in the end, McCain agreed to a deal that essentially allows the president to continue to treat people in violation of the Geneva Conventions, to treat them as cruelly as really he wants, and really to torture people. The definition of torture is so narrow, and I won't go into it. Suffice it to say that this president and this country have essentially authorized the continuation of torture. And as an aspect of that, what they did is because they know they've tortured people for 5 years, and then the Supreme Court said, well, the Geneva Conventions applies, and therefore you can be conceivably prosecuted for war crimes. They decided to give themselves a pardon or an amnesty. And so they amnestied all their crimes of torture and war crimes going back to 1997. Now, I presume they went back to 1997 because they wanted to really say, well, it's not just us. It was Clinton, too, as a way of saying we're not just protecting us, we're protecting Clinton's people. I don't know whether Clinton's people were engaged in this or not. But certainly it became open and public and allowed under this current administration. So you have a situation now where they've authorized torture. When they send someone to Bagram or send them to the CIA secret site, they're going to continue to be able to torture people. And while this act is a very long act and most of it concerns military commissions, which I'm going to mention, the three key aspects, as I said, are denial of habeas, definition of enemy combatant, and the authorization to torture. The fourth part of the act concerns military commissions. Military commissions are a way of trying alleged terrorists. You wouldn't know they're alleged terrorists because when Bush gave his signing a speech on October 17th, Bush said, these are terrorists. Their view, these are terrorists, and therefore terrorists don't get any rights. And the Military Commission Act is the trial. It's a rump trial, a kangaroo court, whatever you want to call it, where the president still acts as prosecutor, a judge. He sets the laws, and it's still a completely unfair procedure. It's going to go to the Supreme Court again. My guess is it's going to be struck down. It still allows evidence to be used from coercive testimony, you know, that people who've been tortured or otherwise abused, still allows the defendant to be excluded from seeing all the evidence. I don't think it's going to make it through, but it's again a disaster. For us personally at the Center for Constitutional Rights, of course, it's a terrible blow, this stuff. We've been to the Supreme Court twice twice. And they've twice said you have the right to the writ of habeas corpus for the people at Guantanamo. None of our clients at Guantanamo have ever had the hearing required for a writ of habeas on a writ of habeas corpus. And twice the Congress has gone and said to the Supreme Court, we're going to overrule you at the behest of the president, but we're going to overrule you. So now we're sitting there and maybe we'll win in another year or two in the Supreme Court. But meanwhile, we at the center and others have 460 men in cages. They've been there for 5 years. They've never been charged. They've never had a trial. Most of them, as far as we know, have never engaged in any terrorist act or even contemplated one against the United States. So we're talking about, as Michael Smith has said, a qualitative change. This is really, as I said, a police state, particularly for non-citizens. It's giving maximum power to the president. I look at, well, why? How does this come about? I'm sure it comes about with weakness of Democrats and all that. But in a sense, Democrats are part of the same picture. It really comes about in a broad sense, of course, in decline of empire, in what, you know, Thucydides said about Athens. Athens, which was making war abroad all the time, eventually, as it brought tyranny abroad, it eventually brought tyranny at home. I do think as pernicious and as nasty as it is, and as lawless as it is, it is an example, really, and the only bright spot is it may be a decline in our empire, that they now feel that to have domestic tranquility at home and abroad, they have to just, they're becoming a dictatorship.
Yeah, I think that their position economically around the globe is substantially weakened. I think just like their foreign policy is to preemptorily have wars abroad to take care of any potential enemies, I think they must be thinking that they've got to get their ducks in a row here domestically as well. They have systematically stolen from the poor and given to the rich, starting all the way back to Reagan and accelerated under Bush. The statistics are that over $1 trillion a year now goes from the bottom up to the top. The unions have been decimated. Healthcare is decimated. Education is going down the drain. The level of poverty is going way up, particularly in non-white communities. People are working two and three jobs. Families are having mothers and children going to work. The situation that we grew up in, Michael, back in the 50s and 60s is totally different now. You know, when our kids get out of school, it's not going to be so easy for them to get a job like it was easy for us. And I think that's true for all Americans. When I try to figure out, you know, why the hell are they doing this? I've got to think they feel that somewhere in the future, maybe not the distant future, there's going to be a big upsurge in this country. There's going to be a lot of unrest in this country. How else can you explain why they just appropriated $385 million to Kellogg, Brown & Root, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton, to build detention camps all over the country? They've got them fully staffed now, and they say they're not just for Mexicans. What are they anticipating? Part of the answer is that these people have power, and they're using their power.
Part of it is a historical answer, I think. I mean, Cheney and his sidekick Addington, who's his lawyer, have talked about how they didn't like what happened after the Vietnam War. There was a weakened presidency and a weakened executive, and really not just a weakened president and a weakened executive, a weakened imperialism, because Vietnam War was a major defeat of U.S. imperialism. And so in 1976, all of a sudden, after the end of the war, you got a war powers resolution that restricts the U.S. ability to go to war. You get restrictions on CIA spying. You get FBI guidelines restricting that kind of spying.
You get an end of the draft.
They get an end of the draft.
They can't.
So you really look
army.
At, there's this period where it looked like there was actually a pushback on imperialism. And then Reagan takes office, and from 81 until really, I think it's culmination today with Bush, because it's a pretty consistent upward line. Clinton just sort of greasing the skids occasionally in this. It's an upward line of saying we want to restore an imperial presidency. An imperial presidency doesn't just mean a president who's boss. It literally means a president who's going to carry out the plan of imperialism. And that's what you saw. Whether you saw it in Iraq, which we saw today, or in Afghanistan, or in whatever country it's going to be next, what we're really seeing is that resurgence. And they basically admitted this. They want to basically, not just on the social issues we won in the 70s around women and in the 60s and blacks, you know, but also around these issues of we are an imperial country and we want to carry out our misdeeds.
Because the one thing they do have going for them and the one thing that they're totally superior in is their army. They've got bases in hundreds and hundreds of places around the world and in over 100 countries.
700 and some bases, yeah, and 118 major bases.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always think about super aircraft carriers. I don't know what they are, but they're very big. And there's only eight of them in the entire world. And I read an article, and of course, they're all owned by the United States, and those are aircraft carriers are important because you can put them with planes wherever you want. You don't even need a base. And they said in the article that if any other country tried to ever build a super aircraft carrier, they would bomb the heck out of them.
Yeah. They've taken control over the major oil supplies in the world, as we saw after Afghanistan. I mean, what you had in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union was not capitalism. It wasn't good. It was undemocratic and it was exploitive, but it wasn't capitalism, and it wasn't an area where American capital could reach into with investments and exploit labor and export stuff too. And it was kind of an island. And the goal, I think, of the United States foreign policy and military policy ever since the Russian Revolution was to reverse that. And they chipped away and chipped away. And finally, in 1991, they reversed that. And I think that it gave the American economy a new lease on life. Just like I think they're getting really a restoration of capitalism through the army in China back in the saddle, gave them a new lease. At this point, unchallenged. But, you know, empires are never totally unchallenged.
I said that my slight optimism comes out of this incredible overreaching in response to really what they probably see as a weakened prognosis 25 years down the line. And if you look at even what's happening in South America, if we're looking for rays of hope, boy. You know, I was at this dinner a few days ago where they honored, as I said, Maha Arar and the Center for Constitutional Rights. It was Institute for Policy Studies. And they announced the people in the audience, the ambassador from Venezuela, first secretary from Cuba, the ambassador from
Bolivia
was there. And I sat, and a couple of others who were from progressive places. And I sat there and I said, this is like the 80s, but it's even better, because in the 80s we had Nicaragua, we had Cuba, yeah. We had Grenada, yeah. But we weren't talking about powerful, rich countries with oil like Venezuela and with
right.
gas like Bolivia. And they were so focused on the dire situation they've given us in Iraq and in the Middle East that these countries are able to thrive to a certain extent and may give us some potential for actually a change as we go forward. I don't know. I'm just hopeful. And I'm hopeful that, you know, what we did in the 80s, of course, which was push back those revolutionary movements, they will not achieve in South America. But it is, when I look at the whole world, that is a hopeful thing. The fact that we got, you know, whatever we think about Iraq, and every dead person to me is a nightmare, Iraqi or American, we basically overreached, did exactly what we shouldn't have. It was predictable what was going to happen. And in really, it is a major setback. Let's be honest, it's a major setback to U.S. imperialist interests, what's happened in Iraq.
Well, because they're trapped in Iraq, they can't go elsewhere. If they weren't so nailed down in Iraq, I would imagine them being even more threatening than Venezuela or Bolivia. But it's what Che Guevara said, create 1, 2, 3 many Vietnams. Well, they've done it in Iraq.
As bad as it's getting here, and I think it may well get worse, or maybe for a few years it'll stay the same, but it does have its reminiscence of Rome to me. The outside, the barbarians so-called at the gates, as they called them, I wouldn't. And then you have internal, you know, huge descent. It took a long time. It did not take 25 years. It took 100, maybe more. We're not talking about the most powerful country in the world, I think, in a few years. Our hopes have to be pinned on, you know, not only what's going on in Latin America, but also on really the internal dissent that we're beginning to build up in the United States. I think Lynn Stewart's case is a victory. I think that even on this Military Commission Act or Police State Act, we did get, on the vote, there was an amendment going on during that period, and I was in Washington for it. We did get 48 votes to save habeas. We missed by only 3 or 4 votes, and that was very significant. I mean, that issue became a big issue. Again, I'm not happy in the sense I don't think Democrats will make the same argument to me. Well, we don't want to lose the next election, you know, by reversing everything that it was done in the name of stopping terrorism. But I do think it's some sign of hope that they saw enough significance that we did get those votes. But again, this has to become a people's movement. And for some reason in this country, this is another problem for me, is, you know, sure, the editorial writers are all writing about this, but most people in this country don't seem to care much. Although, who's this guy, Keith Olbermann? Yeah. His stuff on MSNBC.
It's unbelievable, especially the last one. He spoke more sharply about what Bush has done than I've ever heard. I've been listening to criticisms of American imperialism for the last 50 years, and it was just unbelievable. It's on the net now. People should listen to it.
He had a picture there of, you know, of a tombstone that said habeas corpus, rest in peace, and he just went on and on. It's been, I mean, where he just came out of a, it's like a shot in the arm. I mean, it's unbelievable what the guy did.
This is somebody that's on a major corporate media station, and I think because he's on and he stays on, it reflects something. And I think it reflects that there's some thought outside of movement circles that you and I are in, that something is terribly wrong in this country. And he is getting support to stay on. And the kind of criticism that he's making is really radical in the sense that it's fundamental. It goes right to the roots. He goes right back to the great Democrats that founded this country, all the way back to Madison and Jefferson. He really puts it to Bush. It's really been a ray of light.
Well, I think there's an understanding in this country that the war in Iraq was a huge, huge mistake. It's an understanding in the business class as well. And I think in Wall Street. And not only the amounts of money that have gone to the war, the fact that we're less safe, the fact that it really hasn't helped our oil situation. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
Seré un guajiro dichoso.
Acabar.